Police guitarist Andy Summers has had a solo instrumental career for over 20 years in between stints with the Police. I sat down with Andy Summers in the studio.
You've worked with one of the greatest bands in modern history, and now you've been trekking through the wonderful body of work on your own. What are the pros and cons of each, and what do you miss about a band, and what don't you?
Well, that's a really interesting question.
And long one, and I apologize.
A long one. No, well, there's a couple of good answers to it. Yeah, you know, being in a band like the Police, of course, one of the things that makes the band is all the confrontation, all the spark, all the chemistry that has to somehow come together and make a thing, you know. But, you know, my sort of stock response to that is it's sort of what you want, because you want that kind of sparky chemistry. I mean, if you've got three really mellow guys, it ain't going to work. I think all the really great rock bands are sort of marked by that kind of, you know, that sort of chemistry that really, you know, you have to kind of
squeezing out sparks.
Yeah, no, I say the music of the Police is the sound of tight compromise, you know, and that's what we get to. And that's what, you know, somehow translates to an audience, I think, that there are three egos, or however many, battling it out on stage and making this exciting music. So I suppose, you know, if once you abandon that, you know, and you go to be like the, in quotes, solo artist, and basically you end up sort of paying for other people's services, they're mostly going to say yeah.
To record their third album, the Police went to Holland to save money on taxes, according to drummer Stuart Copeland.
At that point, we'd had the first album, had started to create a buzz. The second album actually had a few hits on it. And this third album was supposed to be the breakthrough. And we had the record company in the studio with us saying, come on, guys, this is... we're going for the big one now. This is where the pressure's really on now. The first two are the setup, and this is your home run, guys. You're on third base now. You know, bases are loaded, you know. And that was the album where we actually really felt the pressure, and it affected the album to a certain extent. There's some of my favorite cuts on it, but there was that atmosphere. And it was after that, okay, we got our home run, then we could take it easy. We went down to Montserrat, which was halfway around the world, 12-hour flight from the nearest record company, and we were able to relax, and we kind of got over that hump. But that album was a tense session. But that was our album where we were able to, as you say, take ourselves importantly. We were no longer a pop group. Now we were a beacon and a group of substance and all this stuff. So we began to take ourselves a little bit serious.
You say that with
the
very
pompous album.
Self-deprecating humor, but personally... you know, we can't rewrite history, and we can't reinvent the Police. The fact is, the Ghost in the Machine album by the Police, whether you want it to be or not, was a very important album for the decade, for the way the band would be viewed from then on.
Our biggest seller, interestingly enough, and that surprised me, because I was never aware of that until many years after the fact. I think an 8-year span. Which is 3 years longer than the average group. They say the average group has a 5-year span. Well, we lasted for 8, so we're proud of that.
Yeah, and it seemed so quick. Even the 8 years, I thought, went by. You were very prolific in a very short period of time.
Spirits, this album...
didn't necessarily sell the most.
Yes, it was not one of our big sellers. And our manager, Miles, kind of had the idea. He figures it was because of the album cover, the black with the red graphics, which nobody understood but us.
No.
Incidentally, the Police were never responsible. We never had anything to do with the artwork on our albums. They would show us the artwork idea. We would say, so they'd show us another artwork idea. And go, so eventually, the one that made us the least nauseous got used, and then for some reason that wouldn't be used, and the one that made us the most nauseous would somehow get used instead. And so anyhow, the guy comes in with this concept, and, you know, well, we really liked it. We immediately saw that it was a graphic, sort of like LED representation of our three faces. And to this day, people still ask me, is it Chinese? What is it? But it's always seemed very obvious to me what it is.
The key to me, I didn't get it, of course, at first either. The key to me was, if you look at the middle symbol,
yeah,
and look at the little spikiness, you little figure out that
Sting's
that
little spiky
hair.
Haircut, yeah.
And once you can fixate on that, then everything else kind of falls into place.
Of course, I was very disgruntled that I didn't, in my face, have any feature that could be rendered unto LEDs to stand out in that way. My face is slightly longer than Andy's.
Yeah.
every little thing she does is magic.
Right.
That was recorded, the demo was recorded in Le Studio in Montreal while Sting was doing something. He recorded this, one of his platinum demos, where he records these demos that sound great, to the intense irritation of his colleagues. And he comes in with a song that not only is a great song, but this time it actually is a great recording of the song. Only he didn't have any drums on it, and he had this guy playing piano on it. We just overdubbed onto his backing tracks. You know, he had his demo. We just overdubbed onto it and then did a bunch more stuff. And that's where the track got. In fact, we tried to re-record it and never kind of made much progress. And one morning, just it was first thing in the morning, I said, look, I'm sick of this. Just put up that demo and let me play to that. And it was really literally one take.
Headed out of town.
We went to Montserrat, which is in the West Indies, and where George Martin, who produced all those big Beatles albums, he built a studio way out there almost for this reason, so that bands could get away from their record companies. I seem to be running the record company down. I really don't mean to. A&M really was a great record company, did a lot of good stuff for us. It's beautiful out there. We didn't get a tan at all because we were in the studio the whole time. Well, actually, we did. We'd the kind of the way we'd work would be that one guy would be recording, overdubbing. The other guy would be in the studio cracking the whip, and the other guy would be out in the swimming pool. We'd kind of rotate in that way, working pretty hard. Occasionally, we'd take a day off. Okay, Thursday, we're going to take Thursday off. Thursday would come, we'd get up, and we'd show up at the studio. We're taking the day off. Oh, sorry, I forgot. We're all there at the studio. Okay, well, what are you going to do today? I guess I'm going to drive around the island, so... We go around by 3 o'clock, we were all bored out of our minds, and we'd sort of drift back to the studio just to see what's going on. And by 5 o'clock, we would have put down another track, and we'd be steaming into it again. And so even though it was out there in paradise, we still worked pretty hard. Actually, the video that we did from that caused a lot of talk. It was funny. You know, we were there and we made the videos while we were recording the album. And there we were in the Air Studios with this famous Air, the big Neve desk. And this, the mixing console, which is where you get up all the different tracks and you know, it's the big main piece of technology in the studio where you do all your magic with the sounds. It was this big, huge desk, you know, full of technology, but a big solid construction. It took up most of the room. The only way out of the room was over the desk. And there we were. We're out there fit. We're in our bathing suits and sneakers and we're, you know, we're pretty agile at this point. We would climb deftly over the desk, being very careful not to break. You know, we knew where the handholds were and where the stress point, you know, and we didn't think that much about it. Anyhow, we're making the video, and part of the video is us dancing around the studio, grooving to the music in, you know, time-honored fashion. We were climbing around the desk very carefully, you know, without even thinking about it, because, you know, we'd been in there for like a month, and we knew that desk. We knew where the footholds and handholds were. But it looks on the video like we're trashing this. I mean, that's probably about $500,000 worth
half
of technology.
$500,000 worth of recording console.
And this
console
was sort of like the Who of, you know, like for recording engineers to see us trashing what looks like we're trashing this Neve desk, which is a big, serious desk. You know, it's sort of like the old days of guitarists watching the Who smash guitars, you know. But this is sort of like the recording engineer's version of The Who.
So what was the net effect when this video came out and people, engineers and the like?
They all thought that we were wild and crazy guys. But in fact, we weren't doing any damage. We weren't even thinking about it.
Were there people who said, I'm not going to work with them because...
No. Okay. Well, that desk is now, that same venerable desk is now sitting at the number one studio at the A&M recording studio. It's in their number one room, so it's obviously it survived the experience out in LA on the lot of the old Charlie Chaplin set. Well, that's the desk. I think it's still got my footprints on it.
You also decided to collaborate with a new producer this time. Who was it, and what was his professional rep up to that point? Why did you use him?
Well, Nigel Gray, who had recorded the first albums in his own studio and had given us a great deal. He'd been almost a part of the band when we were recording those first albums. He kind of fell out with our manager, and he had personal problems as well. And he started to fall apart as a person. And we wanted to go down there. And the question was, do we take Nigel with us? And Nigel was kind of, he was going through a bad period of his life. His marriage was falling down. He was a doctor before becoming an engineer.
A doctor? Yeah. A medical
in fact,
doctor?
He would, in the first sessions that I did with him as Clark Kent, he would leave the studio. Sorry, I'm on call. He'd go out with his black bag and go and heal somebody. But his wife married a doctor and ended up with a rock and roll engineer. And so, and he had, you know, kids and so on. And he just like had to make a choice between also the rock and roll life. He wasn't prepared for it. Us hardened musicians had sampled the rock and roll world, knew what we could take, knew it was for us, and turn our back on the pitfalls, you know. And we were kind of hardened to it. We had our leather jackets. But he was like fair game. All the excesses, all the pitfalls of rock and roll hit this guy fast and hard, and he was shaking.
Oh,
And we got Hugh Padgham, who had worked with Genesis. And I think that the sound, really, just the sound quality of the albums did take a sudden leap forward in the clarity of the tracks and everything. And he was also had the right kind of temperament. You know, the engineer in our group has always been kind of like the umpire in a way. You know, it would be usually democracy, kind of perverted democracy, but it was always two against one. Was pretty much the way decisions were made in the group, but sometimes there would still be an impasse and the engineer would have to like pull us off of each other before there was a fatality. And and Hugh Padgham was very soft, quiet spoken, and actually fit that role very well. And so we went down to Montserrat with a new man, and he recorded new sounds, and he made, you know, for instance, he insisted that we put the drums in the dining room rather than in the recording studio. The drums were in the dining room of this building, which was a wooden room with windows and everything like that. And it was sort of like, I suppose, the discovery of the live drum sound recording technique. And he would, instead of the earlier thing where you get the deadest room possible and you put the microphones right on top of the tom-toms and you mic every drum and every cymbal, and then you sort it out. He did all that too, but basically the sound came from two microphones at the other end of the room that were compressed, and that's how you get that live big sound.
Andy Summers, Sting, and Stuart Copeland will return to explain why the singer always gets the final say. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio.
In the Studio with the Police. I'm Stuart Copeland with Redbeard.
Welcome back. In the Studio, and I'm Sting with Redbeard, and he still has it.
Thank you, guys. In two separate interviews, both drummer Stuart Copeland and guitarist Andy Summers each stated that the singer must have the final say on the basics of a song's key, tempo, etc. Here is policeman Andy Summers.
I mean, I personally don't think the singer rolls. I think the guitarist rolls. So. Not in my mind. You've got to let them think they roll. Yeah, well, anyway, again, we go back. This is the hallmark of a great band. There's a lot of undercurrent. And let's put it in this way. You know, musically, you've got to serve the vocal. If you're doing rock music or any kind of music that's vocal, you've got to serve the vocal because that's the lead line. People are hearing that. So I don't necessarily think the singer rules creatively, but I think, you know, we're all in the position, you know, in vocal music of serving the voice. Creatively.
When Stuart discovered Sting singing in the tiny university hall, Sting was playing jazz, not rock, not pop, or even punk. Mm-hmm. How did your jazz chops and your interest in jazz figure into establishing a musical dialogue with Sting in this new band that you were joining?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question because I think one of the things that does, you know, characterize the music of the Police is that in a very general sense, we're playing rock. It's pop music. It's vocals, you know, it's verse, chorus. But the sound of the Police, the arrangements, the sound between the guitar, bass, and drums is a synthesis of many different musics, you know. What was great for me to find out as I got to know Sting, that, hey, wait a minute, this guy's not just some rock bass player. He's had a jazz fusion group. He knows all this other stuff. He knows about Jaco Pastorius. Then I found out that, you know, he's really into classical guitar, and I'd played classical guitar for years. And so, you know, and you know, but he knew a lot of old stuff. There was a big musical background that went just beyond, you know, pop songs of the day. He was drawing on a big bag, you know, and so was I by that point. We both had a lot of music, you know, that was not just rock and pop, but was also jazz and classical and Brazilian music, interest in Indian music. So once we started to really get into it, we had a lot of references together. But we still had the plan to be a rock band, but we were able to bring some more interesting ingredients into it than maybe some other groups could.
Atmospheric layers would, it seems, present a dilemma, though, for a three-piece band live. Here's Stuart Copeland of The Police.
Well, to recreate the album is a question that many groups face. And The Police, we never faced this. We would make our record, we would do any amount of overdubs and studio stuff to make the record work.
With no regard?
No regard for how we would pull it off on stage at all. We never, you know, we knew that all we had to go out and do it and give us, you know, we didn't even need to play the song. We'll just go out there and, you know, as long as someone remembers the lyrics more or less and gets the chorus right, that'll do. And so we never worried about that. And as I explained, when we get out there, we'd take the basic skeleton of the song and do whatever happened on the night. And there was a lot of variety from night to night as well. We would throw each other curve balls just to keep it live. But in the studio, we would do everything. We would he would even double track the bass. I would overdub drums. The guitars would take up three slave reels of different guitar sounds. He would have a different guitar sound for each chorus and double it and layer it and have the stereo version, and then the solo. He'd spend a day on, you know, we'd use the studio for every trick it had to make the record sound good. Never worry for a moment about what we would do once we got on stage.
I tried before to tell her of the feelings I have for her in my heart. Every time that I come near her, I just lose my nerve. Absorption from her soul. I say, every little thing she does is magic. Every thing she do just turn me on. Even though my life before was tragic, knowing my love for her goes on. See, I have to tell the story of a thousand rainy days since we first met. It's a big enough umbrella, but it's always me that answer. Get away. I say, every little thing she does is magic. Every thing she do just turn me on. Even though my life before was tragic, knowing that my love for her goes on. Every little thing she does is magic. Every thing she do just turn me on. Even though my life before was tragic, knowing that my love for her goes on. She'll marry me in some old-fashioned way. But my silent fears are gripping right before I reach the phone, right before my tongue has to break. Must I always be alone? I say, every little thing she does is magic. Every thing she do just turn me on. Even though my life before was tragic, knowing that my love for her goes on. Every little thing she does is magic. Every thing she do just turn me on. Even though my life before was tragic, knowing that my love for her goes on. Every little thing she does. Every little thing.
This is Redbeard in the Studio, thanking my guests, Stuart Copeland, Sting, and Andy Summers. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net.